From next week, we will begin our series looking at the life of David, a theme which will run us right the way up to the summer months. What we want to do, as well as looking at David, we want to pepper that theme with every now and then just taking a step back and looking at current affairs that have been relevant to us through the course of the week. We often say that the church is supposed to be countercultural. Unfortunately, in my experience, this is usually called for being a little outdated and somewhat irrelevant. But I do believe that we have a God-given call to critique our world and, on occasion, hold it to account. We are called to critique culture, to analyze culture, to ask, what does the Bible say about this particular aspect of our culture at this particular time? So the challenge for our speakers is to look at the week that's just passed and to highlight something in the course of that week and then bring a biblical perspective on it. Well, no surprises as to my subject matter this week. In the last 10 days, the Levinson Inquiry has interviewed the News Corp big guns, James Murdoch, Rebecca Brooks, and the King himself, Rupert Murdoch. They've all completed interviews in front of them, all become part of the investigation, and preliminary findings are beginning to fly around. So I want to spend this evening looking at the Christian understanding of the media. And I wonder if we can spend some time working our way around that particular issue. Yeah, I'm sure the irony of current affairs has not passed you by. The irony of an inquiry that has been set up to scrutinize the role of the media, to begin to understand this circus that has become the media in this country. But the irony of the whole thing is that this very inquiry that has been set up to scrutinize the media has itself become a circus. And games have been played. You would have watched with me over the course of the last week as James Murdoch was under great pressure, being asked all sorts of difficult questions. And what does he do when he's under pressure? What does he do when he's in the spotlight? He uses the tools that he knows how to use. He uses media spin and manipulation. And under the spotlight, he throws Jeremy Hunt's name into the ring. And he suggests that Mr. Hunt was far from impartial in the takeover of Sky B by News Corp. And then, from that moment forward, there's not another mention of James Murdoch. The media circus now is running after a bigger head. It's got a bigger fish that it wants to catch. And so off they go in pursuit of Jeremy Hunt. The same technique was used by Rebecca Brooks just a week later. And she used the same fancy footwork to deflect attention from her with an email that mentioned the initials JH. She was asked, what do the initials JH stand for? Again, she threw them in the direction of Jeremy Hunt, and no more attention was paid to her. These are people who have learned their trade in front of the media. They know how to manipulate the media. They know how to manipulate people's attention. They know how to draw them in all sorts of directions to deflect from finding truth. And then the Select Committee reported this week on the role of the media. And they made that incredible statement that Rupert Murdoch was not fit to run a company. The statement itself, a Select Committee report which could have had some value, some significance, but the whole thing completely undermined by party politics. As the members of the Select Committee begin to squabble with one another, one saying that's quite correct, he's not fit to own a company or to run a company. Others actually saying that they never discussed that, that was not part of the inquiry, and therefore never should have been placed in front of the public at this time. Labour members of Parliament wanting to bring down Rupert Murdoch, Conservative members of Parliament wanting to say that that was not part of their discussion at this time. And so it turns into a bun fight, another element of the media circus, and we can't see truth for the spin that's taking place. Allow me, though, if you would, just one aside. That comment, Rupert Murdoch is not suitable to run a company. In the midst of all these words, I don't want you to lose fact of the fact that this is a fairly significant individual. Rupert Murdoch is now 81 years of age. He started with the Adelaide News in 1952, a paper that he inherited from his father. He had recently completed a master's in politics at Oxford University, and he worked long and he worked hard. And today he's worth $8.3 billion. Amongst his assets are 20th Century Fox, Sky Television, The Times, The Wall Street Journal. Now, I give you that he has indeed behaved badly. And I give you that, yes, he is indeed guilty of willful blindness. Oh, yes. But is he unfit to run a newspaper? Maybe that's a statement too far. This man has done exceptional things. And we don't need to be caught up in the cynicism of the media circus. But such is the work of spin and sleight of hand. We no longer know what to believe. It's been an interesting period of time. And viewed from a safe distance, it's hard not to become incredibly cynical about the whole thing. News Corp newspapers exposed the dishonesty of many MPs through the expenses scandal. And with more and more revelations on the front of the news of the world every week. But before the print had finally dried on those newspapers, even before the final MP was sentenced for their crime, the MP saw an opportunity to bring News Corp itself to its knees, the phone hacking scandal. And within months, the news of the world was no more, and News Corp are on the ropes. Could I be excused for concluding that none of this may have happened if MPs' expenses weren't brought into the open first? I don't know. But it's a question that is worth asking. There is clearly a very unhealthy, symbiotic relationship between the media and the politicians. Sir Humphrey, in Yes Minister, put it rather well on an episode. He asked Bernard, what was the main goal of an MP? Bernard suggested all sorts of noble answers, representing their constituents, standing for particular causes, upholding ethics. And Sir Humphrey sighed and shakes his head and says to him, no, the only goal of an MP is to remain an MP. Politicians are completely dependent on the media broadcasting their successes and not their mistakes. And of course, when the media want to bring down a politician, what they begin to do is broadcast their mistakes and ignore their successes. It's a power game. But this is a power game between Parliament and Fleet Street. What has it got to do with us? Why is it relevant to us as a church? And really, what ought to be the Christian understanding of the media at this point in history? It fills our television news, it fills column inches, but does it really affect us? Well, Russell Brand famously said at this year's Secret Policeman's Ball, the fundraising event for Amnesty International, he said, "We have something in England for those who don't have enough things to be afraid of. We call it the Daily Mail. It helps us to learn to be afraid of everything, particularly if it's something that is different to us. In the last 12 months, the Daily Mail has told us to be afraid of homosexuals. It's told us to be afraid of asylum seekers. It's told them to be afraid of Muslims. It's told us to be afraid of immigrants. And I'd rather enjoy Russell Brand's definition of an immigrant as somebody who used to live over there and who now lives over here. Just pointing out the futility of being afraid of people who are just like us, who've just happened to move location. But I think my personal favourite in regards to the things that the Daily Mail has told us to fear is it told us in the autumn that we should fear snow. Now, I know there might be all sorts of reasons to fear snow, the difficulty in getting around, the possibilities of falling and all the rest of that. But it was this reason that we should fear snow. The Daily Mail told us in October that we should be afraid of snow because it wasn't normal English snow. This was foreign snow. Incredible. Humorous comment from the comedians. But actually, Russell Brand's comments are backed up by the sociologists. According to the Mental Health Foundation, 60% of those who think that people are becoming more anxious or frightened blame the media as the number one source for that fear. In a Mori poll, half of those questioned believe that tabloid newspapers have a vested interest in making people more afraid of crime. Many of our newspapers have done such a good job in promoting how vulnerable the old are that a third of all old people over the age of 60 say they are afraid to go outside. The remarkable thing is, despite the media hype, people over the age of 60 are amongst the safest people group of them all. Only one in every 4,000 is involved in some sort of crime, some sort of assault on their being. Only one in every 4,000. But we find that hard to believe because we have begun to buy into the media lie. We have been exposed so often to being told that our old people are vulnerable and in threat all the time that we find it very hard to believe that only one in every 4,000 is a victim of serious crime. So, what should our response be? How should we respond to this particular circus? Well, firstly, we need to recognise that the media is indeed truly powerful. And it has been for quite some time. It was 1776 when the editor of the Gloucester Journal was summoned to Parliament to apologise for the anti-government propaganda that he had placed in his newspaper. 1776. One sociologist put it this way: he who learns to communicate to a generation ultimately has the power to control that generation. A former director general of the BBC put it this way: media isn't just reflecting society, it's changing it. And I think that's a deeply troubling statement. So, the question is, do we simply step away? Do we bury ourselves inside our churches? Do we dig our holes as the proverbial ostrich and hide our head in the sand? Well, that's exactly the conclusion that Malcolm Muggeridge came to in his book, Christ and the Media. It's written in the 1980s, and it suggests just that. So Muggeridge, a brilliant TV broadcaster, came to the conclusion that TV could never capture that which was holy. It would always somehow reduce that which was holy and bring it to base level. But John Stott, commenting on Muggeridge's findings, had a very different idea. And he said these words: "It's no good blaming the media." Sorry, let me start again. "It's no good blaming the meat and the bacteria that makes the meat putrefy. It's the fault of the salt that's not there to stop it going bad. And if the media has gone bad, who is it to blame? Are you pointing your finger at them over there?" John Stott says, "I point the finger here. It's our fault. It's the fault of the Christian people. If only we could be the salt of the earth as we were meant to be, and refine and reform and rescue for Jesus Christ. The reality, ladies and gentlemen, is this. What one generation tolerates, the next will accept. And we have done a lot of tolerating in previous generations. We've been told often that it's good that we are becoming a more tolerant society. But there are some things that we tolerated that have now become part of everyday life that we really ought to have stood against. And I wonder if we are repeating it again, whether there are some things that we ought to be standing against, some things that we need to be speaking up against, but actually we are proving ourselves to be rather liberal and rather tolerant and allowing those things to take place because it doesn't harm us. What one generation tolerates, the next will accept. The generation after that is likely to wholeheartedly embrace. You see, the directive to us in Philippians, our reading this evening, which talked about us being citizens of heaven, is actually quite complex, but plain to see if we dig deeply enough. Our understanding for many years has been that we are citizens of heaven, and one day we will escape from all this and we will go to heaven and we will be with Jesus, where we will be free from all these difficulties. It's actually not what Paul is saying when he writes to the Philippians at all. When he says to them, you are citizens of heaven, he has a very different outcome in mind. How do I explain this to you? Let's do it this way. In the historical context, let's say you are Rome. That's the dominant power of that day, the Pax Romana. And your empire stretches throughout most of the known world. And you've sent out your centurions, and they have fought, and they have conquered, and they have dominated. And now you want to do something more. What do? You're taxing them, you're oppressing them. But Rome wants to do more than that. It wants to create what Bishop Graham Cray termed a Rome away from Rome. Now, he's a bishop. He is not renowned as a world-class comedian. But they want to create a Rome away from Rome. There's no place greater than Rome, is their understanding. It's the cultural pinnacle of the known world. So do they want to keep that to themselves? No, they want everywhere to be like Rome. So they do it in this way. They've sent out their centurions, their military might, they've dominated, they've won control. They are now the people in charge. They now send out a Roman apostle, that's their word, apostle, a sent one. And he's sent as an ambassador. And his job is to go and establish Roman values and Roman culture, the Roman way of life, in all the places that they have conquered by military might. So he arrives and begins to set up Roman government, Roman councils, Roman authority structures, Roman ways of dealing with crime. He's establishing something of Rome. Very soon, Roman exports begin to arrive in that place, making it more and more like Rome. His job is to come as a Roman citizen to establish Rome where he is. When Paul wrote to the Philippians and said, "You are citizens of heaven," he was reminding them that as citizens of heaven, they have a responsibility to set up something which looks like heaven wherever they might be. The philosophy must not be to escape because one day we're going to heaven. It must be to change our world and bring a little piece of heaven to earth now. Our attitude isn't we one day will be part of God's kingdom. Our attitude must be, your kingdom come, your will be done. So how do we begin to do that? My apologies. How do we begin to do that? How do we begin to establish the values of our King here and now? It was Malcolm McLuhan who said, the medium is the message. Now, it sounds clever, but simply put, he's saying that the medium, the message comes through, colours the message. I think it brings an interesting observation. In many ways, the messenger, therefore, is more important than the message itself. Or more accurately, it doesn't matter if the message is great, if the messenger has no credibility. And right now, media is changing again. The newspaper has been with us since 1445, when Johannes Gutenberg invented the printing press. Until then, the primary focus of communication was not the written, it was the oral. The Church of England itself, its liturgies, are really much a product of modernism flowing out of that period from the 15th century. They're a product of that shifting culture. The Book of Common Prayer is a product of that particular point in history. But all of it really hits its peak in the 20th century. The written word hitting its peak in the 20th century. And now that whole thing is changing once again. On the whole, written media has now lost its power. We don't believe what we read. We've become so cynical towards it. If it's written down in a newspaper, we tend to shake our heads and we say to each other, you can't believe everything you read in the papers. The written word has lost its power. Now remember 1776, when that particular individual has been called to Parliament to answer for the words that he has written. Well, there's no sense of that then. The fact that it is written down in 1776 means it must be truth. We don't have that in 2012. We'll have less of that going forward. We do not believe that which is written down. So what must our response be? Well, culture is once again moving from the written back to the oral and, in many ways, the visual. And with that move from the oral to the visual, what we need are credible communicators. Communicators who will bring the Jesus story in a way which people can understand, but they themselves must be credible. Now, we already begin to understand this. Certainly the BBC understands this. It tries very hard to place certain newsreaders in front of us because we trust certain individuals. So the credible messenger is what we need right now. Credible messengers who will speak into this world. And our prayer must be, Lord, raise up people who clearly communicate. And let's draw this to a close. Let me take you to a wall. And standing on that wall is a watchman. He has in his hand a trumpet. We are, of course, in Ezekiel 33. And the watchman in Ezekiel 33 has a very particular mission. If the enemy is advancing towards you, you blow the trumpet and you blow it loud and clear. It's an unambivalent sound. It's clear for all to hear. And if you blow the trumpet when the enemy advances against this city, then even if the people of the city do not obey the call of the trumpet, their blood will be on their own heads. But if you fail to blow the trumpet and this city is ransacked, its people are murdered, then the blood of the people of this city will be on your head. It's the call to raise up watchmen who will blow the trumpet, who will warn of attacks that could destroy the city. And right now, we're praying that God will raise up credible watchmen who will stand on the wall, credible orators, bold storytellers, those who clearly proclaim Jesus. Give us the credibility to be able to proclaim. As culture makes its next stage of development, its move towards the oral and the visual, let God raise up credible storytellers who can proclaim and communicate his word and his message. And maybe it can begin with us. Maybe we could be those who will blow that trumpet, that ambivalent sound. Sounds the warning. So this is my prayer for this evening. Lord, make us credible messengers who will not tolerate what we don't want the next generation to accept, who will blow loudly the trumpet of warning using whatever methods are at our disposal. Our prayer once again. So Lord, make us credible messengers who will not tolerate what we don't want the next generation to accept, who will blow loudly the trumpet of warning using whatever methods are at our disposal. So Lord, here we are. Send us. Lord, here we are. Send us.